Thank you all. Thank you for coming. My name is John Hamry, president here at CSIS. I want to say a hearty welcome to all of you. We're kicking off this fall series on our military strategy forum, and I especially want to say a thanks to our very good friends at Rolls-Royce that make this possible for us. And General Hailston, thank you for coming. We're delighted to have you here. I understand that you and Admiral Keating were fellow inmates or something, I think, at some previous incarnation. So we're. And I also want to say thanks to H.T. Johnson, very great friend. Thank you for coming. Glad to have you here, H.T. We're very pleased that you're with us. We're going to our format today. We're going to hear from Admiral Keating, and I assume that, sir, you want to just take questions yourself. You're not going to look.
Yes, sir.
So we'll just let you manage questions, and then he's going to be followed by a panel, and I'm going to ask Dr. Mike Green to take the charge at that stage, where we're going to dig a little deeper into these issues that we're going to explore today. Tim Keating is one of our absolutely most distinguished military officers, and I've had the great privilege of knowing him now for a number of years, back to the time when he was the director of the Joint Staff. And those of you who are in the military know that that really is the hardest job, you know, in the Pentagon. You know, the chairman's got a hard job, but he can leave and he can travel. He can get out of there. And the vice chairman, he can get out of there. But the director of the Joint Staff, it's a 24-hour day job. And it's a demanding job. And that's when I first met Admiral Keating and saw the depth of the content of his character. He's a superb officer and a wise and fine colleague. He helped us through lots of issues when I was there. And since that time, of course, he's gone on to much bigger things. He was out at NORTHCOM when we had Katrina. And Tim Keating, more than anybody, made possible the federal response. When we finally got going, it was Tim Keating that was behind all of that. And for a reward, then he got sent to the Pacific Command, you know, and where he is logging all kinds of frequent flyer miles, none of which he can use when he retires. So it's the way we do this in government. We give you all the responsibilities, all the burdens, and none of the pleasure. But we're so fortunate to have a man of your character and capability guiding us in the Pacific now. So Tim Keating, I introduce to you Admiral Tim Keating.
Thank you, John, very much. Thanks. John, if it's okay, I'll come out here and move around a little bit because the focal point of the conversation that we'll have is not yours truly or those of us in uniform. It's the Asia-Pacific region. It pains me, but I have to do this. I've known Dr. John Hamry for quite a while, as he says, and I have found him to be a man of resolute character and unimpeachable integrity. His service has been of great value to us as a country. And that was a pretty good introduction, but, and I said, that wasn't the best introduction I've ever had, John. Now, here's the deal. It was a very gracious introduction, sir, and I'm grateful. The best introduction I ever got, you must be wondering, it was in the late 70s or early 80s. I was a much younger man. It was, I think, Opa-locka, Florida. Much smaller gathering, and the master of ceremonies was late. And so they said, would I mind introducing myself? That was quite an introduction. As John mentioned, we're here representing the 325,000 men and women in uniform and Department of Defense civilians from your United States Pacific Command. I've had the great personal and professional privilege of occupying that office for the better part, over 2.5 years now. And I thought we'd spend a couple minutes this morning with a little bit of a retrospective look. How do things appear today versus what did you think they would look like when you came into office? I'll point out to you, I stand in front of you as a living example of a retention initiative by the Department of Defense. I was, once upon a time, Dave Baird, raise your hand, please, Jumbo. There's Lieutenant Commander Dave Baird. I was Jumbo in 1984 and 85. I was the aide to then SINC-PAC. There's that term, SINC-PAC. I was the aide to Admiral Crowell. So I got to hang around in the back of the room and listen as Admiral Crowell did, certainly at a much higher level, much more eloquent, much more persuasive than I, but I got to listen to the Pacific Command commander talk to all sorts of folks. Well, here I am, 25 years later. I am the guy for whom the bags are carried, not the bag carrier. So for those of you on active duty, there's hope. Stick around. It's too late for Hailson and Moffat, but it's not too late for you. Seen a lot unfold in the Pacific. Like others in the room, I've spent the majority of my professional life in and around the Pacific. My wife and I lived in Japan for a couple of years with the great pleasure of commanding the four-deployed battle group, then USS Kitty Hawk. We've lived in Bahrain for a couple of years where Earl Hailson and I spent an awful lot of time together in issues common to the Asia-Pacific region with the Central Command focus, to be sure. Two tours in Hawaii and a whole lot of cruises in Liberty ports and time spent with our good and great friends and our allies throughout the Asia-Pacific region. I've developed a pretty good understanding for a number of factors that tend to recommend to us that the Asia-Pacific region will be of more and more and more important to us as a country and to all countries in the world over time. We, the United States of America, do $1 trillion of trade annually with countries from the Asia-Pacific region. That's trillion with a T. About 20 million containers annually course the Indian Ocean and or Pacific. 20 million containers. Of the 20 largest ports in the world, 15 of them are in the Asia-Pacific region. 9 of them are right there in China. 9 of the 20 busiest ports in the world are in the Asia-Pacific region and are in the People's Republic of China. Shanghai, now the busiest port by volume in all the world. 5 of the largest armies, we've got 5 standing treaties, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, parentheses, New Zealand. I'll talk about New Zealand maybe in a question and answer. Thailand, Philippines, and Japan and South Korea. On a daily basis, I'm convinced that we are in better shape in the Asia-Pacific today than we were 25 years ago. Reasons are several. I'll start with Japan. Powerful ally of ours. We've got about 50,000 armed forces in the United States permanently stationed in Japan. Now, most of you, all of you, are probably thinking, well, no, wait a minute, there's been an election in Japan recently, and we may have a new government. We're going to have a new government. The Japanese people, dramatic endorsement of a new government. Is that a harbinger of a big change in U.S.-Japan military relations? I don't think so. We're going to Japan next week. It'll be my first opportunity. I've been to Japan 9 times in the 2.5 years we've been in command. So Japan is our most frequent stop, and that's on purpose. I have had conversations recently with the Chief of Defense Staff there, Ariki-san, General Ariki. I'm very confident, almost certain, that there'll be, maybe some discussions about certain aspects of U.S.-Japan military alliance, but writ large, no significant change anticipated. And that's good. We've had a treaty with Japan for over 50 years. They are a strategic linchpin for us in the Western Pacific, and I'm not concerned about any significant changes. Now, there are some interesting parts, have been, are, and will remain topics of discussion in our military-to-military relationship, one of them being the Defense Policy Review Initiative, DPRI. Many of the room know a lot about it. Some of you may have helped the department formulate the Defense Policy Review Initiative. It has about over a dozen important facets to it. the DPRI, including movement of the Navy air wing out of Atsugi down at Iwakuni. The Japanese have built an entirely new runway. Those of you who haven't been to Iwakuni in a while, there's another runway down there. It's not a single concrete strip. They took the top off a mountain landfill and gave us another runway. So the air wing will move to Atsugi. The Japanese and U.S. Air Forces will have a common operational headquarters, if you will, the Yokota Air Base, and so on. There are certain army movements in and around, out of Camp Zom and so on, that are essential elements of the Defense Policy Review Initiative. The piece that attracts more attention is the movement of 8,000 Marines from Okinawa to Guam. Hadn't been the first Marine go yet. Our president, our Secretary of Defense, our Secretary of State have reaffirmed the previous administration's commitment to the United States and Japan executing the Defense Policy Review Initiative. The construction of the Fatinma Replacement Facility, the new offshore but just offshore V-shaped 4,000-foot runways, the Japanese have not begun construction of that facility yet. They tell us they are going to. That is step one in a series of big steps that will, over time, lead to 8,000 Marines and, I don't know, 5,000 or so dependents, 5,000 to 7,000, estimates vary, movement of those Marines from Okinawa down here to Guam. I think it'll happen. I think it's going to be expensive. Think about, and they're going to Guam. Put yourself as the governor of Guam, where your population is 170,000, and all of a sudden, quote, overnight, unquote, 15,000 more people show up. That's a significant, almost 10% increase in your population very quickly. So there are adjustments that need to be made in Guam. That's going to take some money. It's going to take some time. You can't just build new roads, improve your electrical grid, take care of wastewater, put up a new Walmart, and get to schools and the hospitals, and all of those opportunities / challenges that are attendant to a 10% increase in your population. You can't do that overnight. It's going to take some time. But our country has reaffirmed our commitment, so too has Japan, and we'll see what the new government, I don't expect any change in the new government, to execution of the Defense Policy Review Initiative and the significant subset of that being movement of Marines from Okinawa to Guam. North and South Korea. A couple interesting things about North Korea of late. We all saw a former President Clinton in his trip as a private citizen to North Korea, standing there with Kim Jong-il. That was great intelligence for us, or at least great information for us. Kim Jong-il was upright. He appeared to be cogent and capable of entertaining reasonable discussions, and did so with the former President Clinton. We were less certain of those capabilities than we now are. That doesn't necessarily indicate what's going to happen to North Korea, in North Korea, with North Korea, when he does leave the old sod. The succession plan is not clear. We continue to seek, with a State Department lead, resumption of six-party talks, all to end in a certifiably denuclearized peninsula. Overarching goal. We are a ways from resumption of six-party talks, and we at Pacific Command remain firmly in support of State Department efforts, thank you, to get to its certifiable denuclearization. We got about 28,000 or so, 28,005 of our forces stationed in South Korea, Skip Sharp working hard to improve quality of life in conjunction with Republic of Korea forces and agencies, normalizing tour lengths, the years and decades of 1 year unaccompanied for almost everybody. Skip's looking to change that to 2 to 3 years accompanied tours with great housing and great education and great medical and dental care for the young women who go, and that plan is on track. Australia, we were there a couple weeks ago. On Australia, they published a white paper recently. Many of you in the room may have read it. Certainly you've heard of it. There are some folks who infer from certain passages in the Australian white paper that Australia worries about continued long-term U.S. military commitment, capability, presence in the Asia-Pacific region. I talked to Angus Houston, their chief of defense. I talked to a number of staff personnel who helped formulate the paper, who were responsible for the final publication. I don't think that that is an accurate assessment on the part of those who say Australia worries about our long-term commitment. To the contrary, Australia remains committed to the strength of our alliance. They remain committed to exercising and operating with us, the United States of America. They are confident that we will be ready and present all throughout the Asia-Pacific region, near, mid, and long term. The biggest exercise, let me be careful, a very important exercise that we conduct every other year is conducted up here in the north and northeastern reaches of Australia. It is a bilateral exercise. It is a singularly challenging actual conduct of military operations with our partners, with our allies in Australia. Remember now, they have agreed to buy more F-18s. They're going to buy the Joint Strike Fighter. They are increasing their defense budget under Prime Minister Rudd, and their capabilities will increase over time. So they are an effective, powerful ally of ours, and they take care of a lot of issues for us, with us, in the South Pacific reaches that allow us the luxury of not having to commit significant U.S. forces down there because Australia is taking care of it. India. When I was with Admiral Crowe in the mid-80s, he went to India. I was lucky enough to accompany him. The discussions he had were not entirely fulfilling or productive. The engagement opportunities were almost marginal. And not much came of his visit. We just went 3 months ago, on the day their national elections concluded. Now think about that. Think about the national elections in India. World's largest democracy. About 700 million people go to the polls in India. Thankfully, this last election process was conducted without significant terrorist interruption. Don't think for a second that the terrorists didn't want to interrupt the election process, but India was able to consummate their election without significant incident, and about, again, 700 people go to the polls. They have committed to us their desire to increase our military-to-military dialogue, to increase the quantity and quality of our training exercises, to consider personnel exchanges on a more robust, vigorous basis than we currently enjoy. And I'm convinced that India is and will remain a very important partner of ours in a critical part of the world for all of us. Indian Ocean, they'll say to us, what did you call that? Oh, the Indian Ocean. Oh, okay. They pay attention to that sort of thing. They're developing a naval capability that's significant. They are currently undergoing a fighter fly-off. Many of you are probably aware of this. The F-18 of the United States just returned. The F-16 is down there. We'll admit to a little bias. We prefer they buy American. The particular platform, just as long as they buy American, that's fine with us. They're buying some P-8s and other United States military equipment, and that is all very encouraging to us. Let me talk for a second or two about the Philippines, another alliance of long standing. We have about 600 special operations forces currently in the southern islands of the Philippines, Mindanao and Jolo in particular. Our troops are there, and they are all special operations forces. They are not there to conduct kinetic military action. They are not down there fighting Abu Sayyaf or Jamal Islamiyah. Our forces are down there to help the armed forces of the Philippines. By, with, and through those armed forces, we are contributing to the Philippine effort to eliminate violent extremism in the southern Philippines, all throughout the Philippines, but in particular the southern Philippines. I believe our forces have been effective in that they have, the armed forces of the Philippines have rolled up, captured, killed a number of violent extremists in the southern Philippines to the point that the people, the Filipinos in the southern part of the Philippines, now understand that there are alternatives available and even desirable to support of violent extremism. This is not a religious issue in the Philippines. It's an issue of stability and security, and our forces, by providing training, providing logistical support, administrative support, and certain information sharing with the armed forces of the Philippines, have dramatically improved the quality of life for the men and women in the southern Philippines, and it's a very important operation for us. It's ongoing, and I think we'll continue it for a while. People's Republic of China. Some folks might think that we at Pacific Command spend every waking moment worried, wrestling, concerned about the People's Republic of China. We don't. We're watching them. We're paying close attention. But I don't view China as a threat. We don't want them to view us as a threat. They have capabilities they're developing that are of more than passing interest to us. They tend to fall in the under the category of asymmetric capabilities. We have just resumed military-to-military dialogue with the People's Liberation Army. That dialogue was suspended by China in October of 2008 in the moments following our country's announcement of our latest Taiwan arms sales package. China immediately suspended military dialogue. Our president, our secretary of state, our secretary of defense, and most recently, Michelle Flournoy, under secretary of defense for policy, got the talks back on track. And 2.5 weeks ago, Major General Tex Alice, RJ5, went to Beijing, and we officially resumed military-to-military dialogue with the People's Liberation Army. Since that meeting, we have had another multinational session in Beijing of our J4s of the region. 15 or so countries sent representatives. So, mill-to-mill dialogue is back on, it's on schedule. We are anxious to achieve a couple of results. One, to continue this dialogue, to do our best not to have it again suspended for whatever reason. We want to encourage the Chinese to participate in humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, search and rescue exercises as examples of relatively small scale, very important, likely to be executed as disasters continue to unfold around us in the Asia-Pacific region. And China certainly has capabilities that they could contribute. We have invited them to observe exercises, and they have agreed. They sent two or three guys to observe exercise Cobra Gold, most recently in Thailand. And they watched with greater interest than others the humanitarian assistance and the peacekeeping operations that were important subsets of the overarching exercise Cobra Gold. We have asked them to send some of their engineers, some of their lawyers, some of their doctors, as an example, to the United States and to share information and to spend time with us. We're hopeful that those sorts of exchanges will manifest, will grow, and will allow us to perhaps in time have Chinese mid-grade officers at some of our mid-grade professional military education institutions. All of which combine to recommend to me a reason for cautious optimism in the way ahead with China. Offset that, to be very clear-eyed about it, offset that with capabilities they're developing, anti-satellite, cyber, area denial, submarine warfare. They're building some pretty good capability. We're watching it. We want to draw the Chinese out. We want to ask them to manifest their intention for peaceful rise and harmonious integration by exercising, not just with the United States of America, but as many other nations as they would choose to, that we could agree, could participate. I think multilateral is a better way of doing it than bilateral. But we'll let the Chinese make that decision themselves. We'll provide them the offers and the opportunities. We will certainly observe national defense restrictions as to what we can discuss at the Pacific Command, all of which leads me, I'll say again, to be cautiously optimistic about the way ahead with China, and even more optimistic than that about the region in its entirety. Change commands 19 October. Bob Willard will assume command of the United States Pacific Command. Many of you know Bob. There's nobody in uniform better qualified to oversee military operations in the Asia-Pacific region than Bob. He's had the carrier battle group in Japan. He's had 7th Fleet. He's lived all of his professional life in the Asia-Pacific region as well. So he's the right guy to come in. I'll wrap up 42 years of service on that day. And I'm more optimistic today than I was 2.5 years ago. I'm more optimistic today than I was 22.5 years ago. And A major reason for that optimism is the support of the American people. Been at this a long time, almost as long as Earl Hailston. And we move around the country a fair bit. We move around a region a lot. We're on the road 60 to 70% of the time. Everywhere we go, in one form or another, all of these countries, all of them, say, hey, you're the indispensable partner. You, the United States of America, as perhaps demonstrated by those of us who have the pleasure of wearing the cloth of our nation. So the support worldwide has never been better. Our role is instrumental in continuing to assure peace, to maintain stability so as to enhance economic prosperity all throughout the Asia-Pacific region. We intend to do that by emphasizing partnership, multilateral over bilateral, but build on the bilaterals that we enjoy. We need to maintain high states of readiness, and we have to be present. It's a huge chunk of the earth over which we have oversight. And nothing beats American forces being in a foreign country, working with the men and women of that country, developing an appreciation for the culture, emphasizing, at the end of the day, the partnership that we have worked hard, all of you have worked hard, to help us maintain in the Asia-Pacific region. I'm optimistic. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Thank you. I'm Michael Green from CSIS. I'll be leading a panel discussion in the second hour of this program with my friends and colleagues. First, I want to thank the Admiral for a comprehensive and compelling presentation. I share his optimism. We've done polling here at CSIS, U.S. position in Asia, and it bears out everything the Admiral said. Also, I've been asked to remind everyone to raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. We'll give you the mic. One question per customer. Comments disguised as questions will quickly be exposed. We'd like a question. And we'll go for about 30 minutes. And I'll let Admiral Keating choose the questioners that he wants to choose. Thank you.
Thank you, Admiral. John San with CTI TV of Taiwan. How do you see the relaxation of tension across the Taiwan Strait? And you mentioned that China suspended the military-to-military exchanges with the U.S. last year because of the U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. But Taiwan wants to buy the F-16 CDs for a long time. Could the United States postpone that sales for fear of another interruption in U.S.-China military-to-military exchanges?
Yeah.
Thank you.
There are a couple of parts to that question, John. The Pacific Command role in Taiwan arms sales is very limited. It's a national security level decision, and we make input, but it's a national decision, and those decisions are reached at much higher levels. The Chinese certainly pay close attention to arms sales to Taiwan and elsewhere throughout the world. The likelihood of suspension of mill-to-mill should our country make another announcement, I suppose, is a fair likelihood. I hope China doesn't react that way. I hope they will take a little more longer-term view. The national, our country's policy on Taiwan has been on the books since 1979. It's hardly new. And I don't think there's going to be any change to our policy as to whether or not we announce another arms sales, entirely a different matter. The decrease in tension across the straits, I believe, is palpable. I'm convinced it's important. The reasons for it are several. President Ma himself is less confrontational than his predecessor. I think his position is enlightened. PRC is accepting his positions with some equanimity. The seemingly small pedestrian steps that both countries have agreed to take exchange of exotic animals, increase in commercial cross-strait commercial flights, confidence-building measures of various kinds. All of them may be small individually, but they contribute to an overarching sense of stability that is unmistakable, that's gratifying, and that is reassuring. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Donghui Yu with China Press. A couple of weeks ago, when you visited Australia, you mentioned a joint military exercise among the United States, Australia, and China. So I just wonder why this message and invitation was not conveyed through the formal diplomatic channel, but through the media reports. Have you got any response from Chinese side?
I have had no response from Chinese side. This issue developed in a situation exactly like you and I just had. I was in a very pleasant exchange of ideas with various Australians, including some members of the media, and somebody asked me, as best I can recall, well, what do you think about a trilateral with U.S., Japan, and China, or the U.S., China, and Australia? And I said, sure. It has gotten there's more than passing interest in the topic, but it's an idea that I think has much merit. Prime Minister Rudd, as it turns out, has voiced before my comment general support for this sort of notion. I checked with Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston, a good friend of mine who's head of Australia's Defence Forces. He thinks it's an idea worth considering. So. There is much work to be done, to be sure. There are discussions, I'll presume, ongoing at appropriate levels in China to consider this. It wasn't an official offer, if you will. It was a statement made in good faith by yours truly, and I happen to believe that partnership is an essential element of stability throughout the Asia-Pacific region, and a way of demonstrating that is to operate on a multilateral basis with forces from the People's Liberation Army, Navy, and Air Force. I hope it happens. Yes, sir. Good morning, David. How are you, Admiral?
Dave Bells, BAE Systems. And wanted to just ask you a quick question. Appreciate the update from DPRI. And I agree with you that the focus comes along primarily on the Okinawa and Guam move.
Mm-hmm.
But how about in Korea? You know, there's we're coming up with a expected change of responsibilities significantly coming up in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on in Korea in terms of relocation south. Could you just talk a little bit about that, and you see that going on track, particularly with the change of operational control?
Yeah. Short answer, Dave, I see it on track. We, Pacific Command, see it on track. I think Skip Sharp, if he were standing here, I think Skip would say he sees it on track. We have been firm and consistent in holding ourselves and our ROC allies to that agreement. There is no question that some elements in South Korea would like to delay transfer of operational control in event of war and have it retained by the United States leadership there. Skip Sharp, April of 2012, our Secretary of Defense, our President have all, I'll be careful, if I recall the President did, but I know the Secretary of Defense, in discussions at the ministerial level, have reaffirmed our commitment to operational control transfer in April of 2012. It is, from our position, desirable. It is achievable. And so we'll get there. Skip is conducting significant exercises. We play a support role to the United States Forces Korea leadership in those exercises. Many of you have participated in those exercises. I think Earl was just there a couple weeks ago, probably. We're on track. South Korea's working toward certification. They'll get there, and it's where we all want to be in April of 2012, and I believe we'll get there. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Paul Eckert of Reuters News Agency. The U.S. official position on North Korea regarding nuclear weapons is they'll never recognize them as a nuclear power. But as a practical matter, they are advancing their capabilities, both with the missiles and the nuclear tests, presumably. Does that change the calculus in how you view North Korea in terms of defending the region?
No. We watch North Korea as carefully as we can. That's pretty carefully. North Korea will conduct activities that are perplexing in some ways. If it was a nuclear test, certain agencies say it was. I think the chairman has said he doesn't argue with the evaluation that this big seismic event was caused by a nuclear. Certifiably, North Korea has tried to launch at least two Taepodongs since 2006, and neither one a successful launch. In both cases, we were prepared to defend. We, the United States, then Northern Command, now Pacific Command, were prepared to execute whatever guidance the President's Secretary of Defense gave us, and guidance was pretty clear. We were ready to defend. But the longer term, a certifiable denuclearization of the peninsula is the goal of the six-party talks. We support our Department of State in their lead role there. And whatever military action and positioning and capabilities are necessary for that support, we are prepared to provide and have provided. Sir.
Good morning, Admiral. Brian Kelly, Coast Guard.
Hello, Brian.
Thank you for your service, first of all, Admiral. And secondly, I haven't heard you speak very much about Indonesia, and I was wondering if you could take a moment to comment about them and their capability and their role in the area. And then, kind of like a tag along, if I'm allowed, the notion of piracy among this vast amount of maritime transportation that's going on. Have there been lessons learned that you've taken that have been able to be applied over off the Horn of Africa?
Yeah, great question. Great questions. Let me talk about piracy first, because then I'll work into Indonesia. A lot of you know, this little body of water right here, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, Thailand, Philippines, all have more than idle interest in the Strait of Malacca. 80% of the oil that goes to China, that goes to South Korea, that goes to Japan, that goes to Taiwan, 80% of that oil goes right through here. To get there, it has to go across the Indian Ocean. There are about 8 to 10 ships every hour, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, going through the Strait of Malacca. 5 years ago, there were around 40 to 45 incidents of piracy in the Straits alone. This past year, less than 5. It depends on who's kind of counting. But somewhere between 2 and 5 incidents of piracy. Why? What's the difference, one might say? You guys, Coast Guard, helped us inform and teach the military forces of Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, principally, Thailand, and the Philippines, how to conduct law enforcement operations in open ocean. We, the United States of America, provided certain equipment to Indonesia and Malaysia in particular, Singapore secondarily, and we helped them train their forces so as to conduct multilateral military operations to ensure, to increase stability and the ability to access the maritime domain freely in the Strait of Malacca and in waters surrounding Indonesia and Malaysia. So the effects of our efforts and the fact that countries, Indonesia and Malaysia, have well understood rules of law and forces who are empowered to enforce international and national law lead to a near zero incident rate of piracy in the Strait of Malacca. Is some of that transferable to the Gulf of Aden? You bet. Critically missing is the element of rule of law in countries that would border the Gulf of Aden. I think the number of countries who have ships in counter-piracy operations in the Central Command AOR and Africa Command AOR. It's about 15 countries at last when I last checked. We've got ships there. China has ships there. Japan has ships there. South Korea has ships there. India has ships there. Australia has ships there. The coalition task force will be led in January, February, March by a Singapore flag officer. China chooses not to participate as an element of the coalition, but they're communicating with other ships in the coalition on bridge-to-bridge email and flags and that, you know, the stuff that Navy and Coast Guard folks do. But the fundamental issue is the nations whose shorelines border the Gulf of Aden and the southern part of the Red Sea. So I think that the likelihood of a similar decrease in incidents of piracy in the Gulf of Aden is not so high as it has been demonstrated in and around the Strait of Malacca. Indonesia in particular, 10, 15 years ago, the armed forces of Indonesia, some of them were accused of pretty significant human rights violations. Today, not happening. The special forces, Kopassus, we would like to train a little more with them. There are certain proscriptions as to the activities we can conduct with Kopassus. We're working with the Secretary's office, both state and defense, to get another look at those statutory restrictions so as to allow us to engage more vigorously with the Special Operations Forces, Kopassus of Indonesia. Think of how Indonesia has felt the sting of violent extremism. Attacks in Jakarta 2 months ago, 9 people died. Thankfully, none of American, but tragically 9, 3 of them Australians. And then the Bali attacks 2.5 years ago, 208, I think, the fatalities, 80-some of them Australians. So Indonesia certainly understands what it's like to be engaged in the struggle against violent extremists. We are encouraged by the work done by Indonesian law enforcement and military officials and intelligence officials, and we've got fairly vigorous information and intelligence exchange program with them so as to make it much, much tougher for violent extremists to operate in the vast reaches of the Indonesian countryside and shoreside, to make it increasingly difficult for those misguided folks who would lend administrative or financial or logistical support to violent extremists. Indonesia is doing an increasingly effective job of restricting, eliminating, putting the noose around the neck, a little strong, reducing the impact of violent extremism in Indonesia. I can hear about that. That's all right. I mean, that's what we're doing. We want to capture or kill those guys at the end of the day. Their goals are the same as ours. 210 million, 220 million people, most of them Muslim. They're a very strong partner of ours. They're not an ally. They don't particularly like to be considered an ally, but they like us around. Once again, they view us as the indispensable partner. And we are happy to engage with them on that basis, and we want to continue to develop the relationship that is building since in the past 10 years or so. And remember, they just had nationwide free elections, and President SBY was reelected, and I've had the pleasure of meeting him once, and he is committed to the strength of our partnership. Thanks. Good question. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'm from Moonroom News Agency, South Korea. Do you see any signs of North Korea conducting another nuclear test? Also, how would you assess North Korea's ability to produce nuclear weapons with uranium, not the plutonium? And how did you assess the strength of the North Korean nuclear weapons contested in May? Thank you.
Should have stopped one question ago. The goal of the six-party talks is clear: certifiable denuclearization. It seems to us very much in North Korea's interest to permit certifiable denuclearization inspections. In so doing, they would take a great step forward in verifying their goal to be a reasonable actor on the world stage, if you will. I can't comment on numbers of nuclear weapons or uranium or plutonium. Those are intelligence matters, and I can't go into it. But I will say that all of the other parties in the six-party talks have, we share, and think about that. This is China, Russia, Japan, South Korea, and the United States. A pretty diverse, large element representing, I'm confident, a vast majority of the rest of the nations in the world, all with a single, easily enough obtained goal. And North Korea's leaders know what we seek. Not just we, the United States, but we, all of us, South Korea, China, and everyone. They should not proliferate. They must not proliferate. They should enable inspection of whatever facilities they have and think of the benefits that this will yield for the people of North Korea. Significant improvement in a miserable quality of life. So achievement of six-party talk goals, one foremost, certifiably nuclearization. We at Pacific Command are in support of the State Department lead here, and I hope within my lifetime that we can see that. I don't think we'll see it as long while I'm on active duty. That's just another month. But I hope within my lifetime we can see progress made toward certifiable denuclearization. Thanks.
Thank you,
gentlemen.
Let's thank
Admiral. Thank you, John. Always a pleasure. Thanks.
You can see why we were so anxious.